BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Pat McGrath. Often described as the most influential makeup artist in the world, her creative vision sets the bar for beauty trends across the fashion spectrum, from high art to the high street. She is as famous for creating avant-garde looks as she is for her mastery of that devilishly difficult beauty canvas, perfectly radiant skin. A self-taught, self-made beauty multimillionaire, her influence on the industry she works in has been evident throughout her 30-year career. She cut her teeth working for free for street style magazines and touring with music collective Soul to Soul before going on to collaborate with designers including John Galliano, Alexander McQueen, Dolce & Gabbana, Givenchy and Prada, and on hundreds of editorial shoots and magazine covers. She's widely acknowledged as the most prolific runway makeup artist of all time. Known by the affectionate nickname Mother, she is famous for her indefatigable creative curiosity and make-it-happen attitude, both of which must come in handy since her schedule includes up to 80 major fashion shows a year and helming her business, an eponymous makeup range recently valued at $1 billion. She says, "Beauty has nothing to do with gender, race or age, and it has everything to do with confidence, individuality and character." Pat McGrath, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Hello, happy to be here.
Now, as I mentioned, one of the things that you're famous for is your ability to create stunningly artistic looks, everything from impossibly intricate jewelled face masks that we saw at Givenchy to huge bird-like feathered eyelashes and eyebrows at McQueen. Where do you start when you're creating a look for a fashion show or an editorial shoot?
You meet with the designers, you look at the clothing, and, you know, I am really a shoe bag clothing addict. So I'm really scratching to get into the door to see all the new creations. And you talk about who is that woman of the season or that man of the season. And you're also given abstract words for the beauty. Vinyl, love, adorned princess from out of space or something, or a lip that looks as if it's made out of the stars. I mean, it's insane, the briefs that you're given. So you have such a challenge to come up with actual faces that match.
For listeners who don't know so much about the fashion industry, can you give us some idea of the logistical requirements of working on a major fashion show? I mean, from your point of view, what does it involve?
I mean, we're talking 87 suitcases, sometimes 100 team members, 5 to 6 motorcycles, 8 cars, 4 vans. The team collectively travel 30,000 miles per season. I think that's how much we travel. But I always look at us as an army, and it's military precision. The show has to go on at 10 a.m. Maybe we'll have started at 4 a.m. And, you know, I'm a little bit like a general, marching around the tables, going eyebrows on, skin done, lips on. The adrenaline is magical.
So we're going to hear your first piece of music now. Tell me about this track and why you chose it.
Diana Ross, The Boss, right? For me, as a little girl, prancing around the living room, she's the icon. The eyes, the lashes, the gloss, the face, the voice, it was too much. The visual, everything about her. And also, you know, it reminds me of my early days of waiting for the Avon lady. If she said she was coming at 4:30, I was there at 4, looking out of the window, waiting for that beauty boss, the Avon lady. And she would come into the house and my mother would have to fight me off her. Because, you know, the samples and the minis, it was embarrassing, and I'd get thrown out sometimes for insubordination. And playing in the background would be my Diana Ross song, She's the Boss, you know. And so now I'm a boss, so this song means a lot to me.
My pocket for fools, folly and fun. Love had to show me.
Diana Ross and The Boss, taking you back to Waiting for the Avon Lady, Pat McGrath. How important are relationships in your work? I mean, for example, when you've got a model in the chair or a client in the chair, there's something very intimate, isn't there, about touching someone's face and changing the way that they look?
Yes, it is really intimate. You're very close with whoever you're making up, and you have so much fun, and they always open up to me.
Well, it leads to some very interesting conversations, I would imagine, that intimacy.
Yes, it's great. I love it. You know, I love to give advice.
So you're not a fence sitter. You'll come straight out and say what you think.
Oh, darling, pack your bags, order the car. There's plenty more where that came from.
And what about when you get the chance to make up one of your heroes? What's that moment like for you?
Well, I'm always very nervous, but I always do a dry run where we get all the timing perfectly so that we know we're within that 45 minutes or an hour, whatever is needed. So I will have prepped that for days before, and I'm kind of shaking inside, and then I get my act together once somebody arrives. But I always get very nervous and excited by it.
So you're not bringing your own nerves to the set, but you must have to deal with other people. How do you deal with that, with, you know, ego and insecurities and things like that?
Well, I mean, insecurities, I understand it because, like, for instance, me coming on here today, you know, I'm nervous wreck. I mean, I know I shouldn't be, but I am. I put myself in their position, and I know it can be nerve-wracking. You've got to go on stage. You're out there, you're in front of the public. So it's about soothing nerves and also just letting everybody know everything is going to be all right. And in the end, just to turn it into a light, fun day, that's how I deal with that.
And tell me about your own signature look, because, you know, like many people who work in fashion, you love black.
My signature look is really about making my skin beautiful. And I always love mascara. I put that on, layers of that, and a little bit of eyeliner, shimmering highlights on the cheekbones. I like very simple beauty. My obsession is putting makeup on other people. They're my canvas. And that's my joy.
Pat McGrath, we are onto your second disc today. Tell me about this one. Why did you choose it?
So David Bowie, Life on Mars. The androgyny, the bleached eyebrows, the colour, the clothes, the fearless use of gender. He's really, in a way, every makeup artist's dream.
David Bowie and Life on Mars. Pat McGrath, when you were picking up the Isabella Blow Award for Fashion Creator from the British Fashion Council, you said that your work was all about obsession, inspiration and fantasy. Yes. Where did that begin?
Really, for my mother, she was obsessed with makeup and clothing. And basically, I always say I was hothoused into the industry because the process that she took me on is the process that I do every day. So she'd take me into the store where you buy the patterns to make the clothes. And then she'd take me to the fabric store and I'd have to watch her choose fabrics, the remnants. Then the journey was into the makeup store to choose the makeup. Hours of choosing the makeup. And of course, back then, there wasn't the colours that were right for dark skin. So there'd be one colour a week that was right. And she'd say, we found it. Now we can go food shopping. So I'm really grateful to her for inspiring me and making me who I am. But back then I used to beg her not to take me. I was crying and I was the youngest and I had to go. She'd be like, get your coat. And isn't that amazing that it became my obsession?
And how would you describe Jean's look, your mother Jean's look?
Well, she'd wear lots of different colours on her eyes and she'd wear, you know, tons of makeup. Then she'd bathe to give it that dewy finish from the 70s. And she'd stand in front of the TV and, you know, she wouldn't move until I told her what was different. Can you imagine? Then she'd do different hairdos all the time. It would be black one day, then red the next. So she was just insane with about beauty and looks and just very natural and down to earth. So it was just very normal to me.
And fashion too. I mean, how much of that was accessible to you growing up in, you know, she's single parent in Northampton.
Yes. Basically, she'd make us also go to vintage stores. And then she'd be in there getting all these amazing dresses from the 40s, bias cut dresses, tuxedos. And I remember my sister and I all of a sudden watching a documentary on Blitz Kids and realising that we had all of this stuff in her bedroom. We had it all, everything. She'd been collecting it from when we were young. Thank goodness.
And where did she wear it?
Nowhere. She just was a, I think, hoarding, I think they call it. She just had it all at home and she would try it on. But also she'd talk me through every outfit and the decades and what this pleating meant. And, oh, look at this dress. It's now in fashion.
You've also described your childhood as very difficult and very hard. And in what ways was that the case?
I mean, basically, I mean, we had no money. And I think it was very difficult and hard for her. But for me, she didn't let me know that it was difficult and hard. For me, it was a little bit of a wonderland because she was escaping off into, you know, makeup world. And she allowed me to go there with her on these, how can I say it, these imaginary journeys of glamour.
It's time to go to the music. This is your third disc. Why have you chosen it?
Missy Elliott, I Can't Stand the Rain. The fact that she takes a track that was done by Ann Peebles, Tina Turner, spins it on its head, hires Hype Williams to do the music video, and she's in a huge inflatable look. And also the fact that she's different from everyone else and she celebrates her differences, her full lips with extra gloss, her eyebrows jewelled. I just love the braveness of Missy Elliott and the beauty of her.
When the rain hits my window, I take it, me some, me and Timberland, ooh, we sang a jangle. We so tight that you get our styles tangled. Sway your do-si-do like you loco. Can we get pinky tonight like Coco? So-so, you wanna play with my yo-yo? I smoke my on the D-lo.
Missy Elliott and the rain. Pat McGrath, your makeup addiction took root then when you were growing up in Northampton back in the 70s. What were the products that you had access to at the time like?
I had a lot of skincare, which was my mother's skincare. She didn't like me to touch, but I did use it. And then I'd have one lipstick or so out of her hundreds of lipsticks. And I would use that lipstick as an eyeshadow. Very futuristic. And that was my look.
And this inventive approach might have stemmed from your mum's attitude to makeup, because she had some very inventive ways of working around the scarcity of makeup that was available for black skin.
Oh, yeah. She even used cocoa powder. She came in from the kitchen with cocoa powder all over her face. And she's like, this is the right tone of powder. And she had dusted it on her face and she looked amazing. So that's what I ended up doing as well, was making products that I needed backstage. That stems from my mother. If you can't find it, you can't buy it, make it.
And do you remember the first thing that you made when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah, a moisturiser. I made my own moisturiser for my dolls and myself. And I mixed oil and water together, whipped it, put it in a fridge, and it looked like a cream. So I celebrated for months with my own cream that I'd made, and I packed that all over my face. I was shining like a Belisha beacon for months.
And, I mean, growing up in Northampton in the 70s, it's a different place, a different time to look back on now. I mean, what were there any negative experiences? You know, to what extent did you experience racism?
I mean, you grow up in a community from when you're a child, and then also going to church, you had a really solid base around you. I was very lucky having the mother that I had who was like, oh, look at that person, they're racist, poor things. Anyway, let's go shopping. And I think that really helped.
You were also close enough to go to London and go clubbing there by the time you became an art student. Where were you going out?
Soho. Sneaking into nightclubs with my friends. I'd go to the WAG club. Obviously, my mother didn't approve of that. And so we lied and we'd tell her that we were going to art galleries. And then I'd come home, my clothes were filled with sweat and smoke. And she said, they smoke so much in those galleries. And I just said to her, yes, it's a terrible, Mum.
And what was your look like when you were a clubber?
When I was
in the
clubber,
early days, maybe.
It would have been MA1 bomber jacket with the orange liner, leggings, Travel Fox trainers, high tops, big hoop gold earrings. And I looked so good as well then, you know, my little skinny leggings.
It was around this time that I think BBC DJ Janice Long spotted your skills.
Yes, she did.
Where were you? What happened?
I'd go to London to stalk celebrities because I was obsessed with Blitz Kids, the whole of the Blitz Kids, and they were going to be at the Radio 1. It was here. And I was waiting outside with all the fans. And Janice Long came out and she went, oh, my God, look at your makeup. It's amazing. Because I'd got my lipstick on my eyes and my cheeks were really burgundy. And she said, I'd love it if you could do that on me. And I went, is that a job? And she said, yes, it is a job. So I found my calling right then and there.
Pat McGrath, it's time for your next disc. This is your fourth, and I think it's going to take us to the Blitz Club. Tell me about this next one.
Well, I was obsessed with a magazine called New Sounds, New Styles, and I'd collect them all, and I was completely shook by the looks, the hair, the makeup, the clothes, the total used without caution, you know, boys in major beats and girls giving strength with their looks and their makeup. And I would skip class to follow everyone from this magazine. It's such an important moment in beauty for me.
And this is the soundtrack.
It is. Fade to Grey by Visage.
Fade to Grey by Visage. So Pat McGrath, that taking you back to a time when you were obsessed with the Blitz Kids, following the you know, the people who came out of that club scene in their daily endeavours. But how were you supporting yourself while you were doing that? How were you making a living back then?
Oh my goodness. I mean, back then I was working on the King's Road in a shoe store. And then also I ended up working in the Department of Transport. Many normal jobs funding that nightlife.
I think it was in London during that time that you met influential fashion director Kim Bowen of Blitz magazine. How did that happen?
That, again, was at the WAG Club. I met Kim Bowen. She loved my hair. At the time, I had tied thousands of rags onto little braids, so it looked like I had this kind of fabric hat on. And, of course, the bomber jacket, of course, the sneakers, and, of course, the hoop earrings. And she came up and said, wow, I love your look. And she was with Stephen Jones, the milliner, and they both loved my look. And she said, what do you want to be? And I was like, a makeup artist. And then she said, OK, come with me. I'm shooting this weekend and I'd love you to come and watch. And I would go and watch her shoot for ID, The Face, Blitz magazine. And she just let me come and watch and soak it all up. And kind of that was the best schooling ever.
Is it true that you and your friends would pretend to be fashion editors to get into fashion shows?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Fake ID.
Oh, we'd have fake ID. So we'd have fake Vogue cards. It'd be me and Edward, Edward Enninful from British Vogue. And we were like, and we'd pretend to be the editor of Jamaican Vogue. And we'd dress up and go to all the major fashion shows. And back then it was easier to get in. We'd sneak in or rip the side of a tent and go into fashion shows.
Under a flap.
And then in the end, all the PR firms knew us and they were like, this is ridiculous. You are in Italian Vogue seats and you need to get up. And we'd be like, no. Defiant. We felt we deserved to be there.
We'll come to Edward Enninful later. Tell me first, how did you end up on a plane to Japan with the band Soul to Soul?
Oh, it was with Karen Wheeler. It was a moment in my life where I've been trying and trying to have my own work and my own clients. And I said to myself, it's time to give up, time to find a regular job. And I'm not lying, the phone rang. And it would have been Karen Wheeler's management asking me, could you do a tour to Japan? And that was it. And then I went to Japan and I was scared and I was shaking. But it was a miraculous moment in my life and an incredible trip. And that's how that began.
It's time to go to the music. Tell me about your fifth disc. Why have you chosen this one for us today?
Oh, Malcolm McLaren, Madam Butterfly. Malcolm McLaren's always been such a huge inspiration. In 2007, at John Galliano's Spring Summer Haute Couture show, this song played, Madam Butterfly, and it was the most magical moment. And I remember Shalom Harlow, supermodel. She had a dress that was 50 foot long. We'd have makeup teams on little ladders to reach the models' faces. I remember at one point, you'd have your bowl of foundation, you'd be running to the front of the queue, and there'd be a black horse funeral carriage racing behind you to the stage. Huge butterflies raining from the skies during the shows. Everything was surreal. It was all about a mashup, worlds colliding. And that's how I love to work. So this song means a lot, the goosebumps that I get, because it brings memories back for me and my team, and it's magical.
I'm going back and visit her. She got a problem. She got a little cho-cho. Cho-cho Sam was her name. And Mr. Taylor Wolf. Take it away, cho-cho.
Malcolm McLaren and the 12-inch remix of Madam Butterfly. Pat McGrath, one of the people who had a profound impact on your career is your longtime friend and collaborator, Edward Enninful. Now, he's the editor of British Vogue now, but what do you remember about him when you first met? Because he was only 18 back then.
Yeah, he was a baby. And I'd been working in the industry for quite some time. And I just remember, you know, in between all of my jobs, someone says, oh, there's a new young lad at ID magazine. His name's Edward. Let's pop in and see him. Because back in the day, you never needed appointments for anything. You just basically barged in. So we were in Covent Garden, went to the ID offices, walked up, and there was this shy, quiet young boy who never spoke. And I walked in and I was like, with my loud self, he always blames me. He said, I'm the one that made him loud. Because now we're both booming voices, screaming at one another all day. And I was like, hello. And he was like, hello. You ask him, it's true.
I think he says about you that you always had the confidence to create trends rather than follow them. And that he remembers you demanding a yellow eyebrow in ID during the kind of very barefaced grunge.
Yes. Oh, yes, I'll remember that. I demanded the yellow eyebrow. Then I changed my mind and I called him up and I said, Edward, you got to retouch that yellow eyebrow. I'm having second thoughts. And he went, too late. It's gone to press. I was like begging for mercy. I said, you've got to get rid of it. Panicking. But yeah, it's about freedom of expression. Makeup, you can do anything you want. That's what I believe. And you wash it off in the end. It's not permanent. So it's always best to push yourself and have fun with it.
Tell me about working with Steven Meisel. In 1994, you were booked to work on a jeans commercial with him, one of the most highly regarded fashion photographers in the world. Now, I know that you've gone on to collaborate on hundreds of shoots
since then.
What was your first collaboration like? Didn't I read that you ordered cocktails for everyone on set?
Oh, you knew about that. Okay. So, coming from England, right, on the shoot, there'd always be beers and alcohol. And I didn't realise that working with Steven Meisel, it was clinical. It was excellence to the heightened degree. The room is at the perfect temperature. The music is playing. The girls are dancing. I turn around to this editor and I said to her, because like in England, it's beer time. You know, it's noon. I said, do you think I should get cocktails and drinks? She said, I really do think you should. She set me up. So I went and bought tequila shots and I bought beers. I didn't even drink. And I was running around the studio offering glasses to everybody, including Steven Meisel. And he was like, no, thank you. And I thought, how funny, everyone's declined. And basically, I should have been fired. Now that I know the rules of being on set, I mean, how out of order was that?
No harm done, though.
And no one drank. No harm done. Ended up with a lifelong career with Mr. Mizell, the genius.
Time for your next track. Tell us about your sixth today.
Oh, Vertigo by Bernard Herrmann. Basically, this is a song that I played when my lipstick was launched, Matt Trance, and I met an incredible digital artist on Instagram. And we collaborated on a movie, and it was all about molten metals. And this beautiful music from Hitchcock's Vertigo playing in the background.
Bernard Herrmann's soundtrack to the Alfred Hitchcock film Vertigo. Pat McGrath, I think you once said fashion is an industry where the real insiders are all outsiders. Tell me more about that.
I think everyone from within the industry are obsessive people. They're obsessed with the perfect pleat or the perfect hairdo, coming up with new ideas. And I always think that people on the inside of the industry are very geeky. And it's not what you'd expect, the way that people actually look within the industry. It's like me running around like Darth Vader, all in black, you know, with probably not much makeup on. And I always think that the insiders are outsiders. They're the ones that probably were not the coolest at school, I think.
Your mother died in 1992, so she did see the beginning of your life as a makeup artist. Yeah. What do you think she would have made of your career today?
Oh, she would have been so proud. I think she would have been with me at most of the shows, probably directing. I think she would have been there pointing out certain mistakes or how we could make things better. And I do believe that she's with me anyway every day. She would have been there 100%. I would have loved her to have been there.
Let's hear your seventh disc today. What have you chosen?
Bjork, All Is Full of Love. I remember being a young makeup artist and working on Bjork when she was in the Sugar Cubes. It's so hard to choose, you know what I mean, a track from Bjork, but this is the one when I think about the Chris Cunningham video and the robotic beauty and the whole skin fetish fantasy for me. And, you know, I don't know, inhuman perfection married with human passion. And She's extraordinary.
A makeup artist's dream as well.
Oh, a real makeup artist's dream.
You are staring at, trust your head around. It's all around you. All is full of love.
And All Is Full of Love. Pat McGrath, it could be said that there's still a bit of a skinny and white bias in the beauty and fashion industries. Do you think that's changing in 2019?
I mean, really and truly, that was the standard of the fashion industry, you know, when I was growing up. But I'm so happy to see the changes that I'm seeing now. You know, we have models from all different social backgrounds, different weight, body types, different religious backgrounds, shows that are over 50% women of colour. And it just wasn't there for such a long time. And now it's just so fantastic to see. Beautiful.
You've been mentored throughout your life, beginning, of course, with your mum. How important is it to you to pay that forward and to mentor others?
It's the most important thing, because I know if it wasn't for certain people looking out for me, I would never have happened. So I always love working with young makeup artists. We'll meet on Instagram, they'll send me their work, and I'll say, are you in town? Get to the tents and we'll try you out. So it's great.
You're off to our desert island soon. I imagine that you have more experience of islands and tropical climes than many castaways because you'll have shot so many times in those kinds of environments.
Yes, I have. We've sometimes had the makeup cart on the edge of a cliff in 100 degree as you watch your lipsticks melting. So you need your ice buckets. You need your iced flannels to cool you down. It's insane. All the electrical fans and everything.
Well, of course, you'll have none of that. No phone, you know.
My four phones.
I mean, you can't even have one of the four. How will you cope, do you think?
I think I'll do very well indeed. I'm very resourceful.
It's time for your final disc today. Tell us about this one and why you've chosen it.
I'm a massive fan of Grace Jones, and she's a groundbreaking legend. You know, she's a woman of Jamaican heritage, just like me. When I think about the strength and beauty of Grace Jones, I think of my own ancestry with pride. The makeup of Grace Jones, the hair of Grace Jones, the colours that she uses. Recently at a Valentino show, Pier Paolo played La Vie en Rose, and it was just such a moment of joy, and it inspired one of my palettes. And Grace Jones, La Vie en Rose.
Grace Jones and La Vie en Rose. Now, Pat McGrath, I'm about to cast you away to your very own desert island. I will send you there with the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to read. You can also choose a book of your own to take. What will that be?
Well, me being a very visual person, I would take Andy Warhol's Polaroids, because Andy was the first. Instant glamour, instant fame, instant gratification. Every makeup that I've ever done, I've taken Polaroids of them. Thousands and thousands and thousands of Polaroids. But when I think about that, it's like that Andy Warhol Polaroid book is kind of like the genesis of what we're living in now, you know? So that's my book. Grace Jones was in the book. Debbie Harry was in the book. So, yeah, I've gone with visuals.
Well, you're very welcome to them.
I can't scroll.
It's all yours. You can also have a luxury item to soften the blow of your isolation a bit. What would make life on the island more bearable for you?
Oh, it's a very difficult choice, that. I said I'd bring makeup with me, all my eye palettes and lipsticks, because I don't get time, you know, to do my own makeup the way that I'd love to do my own makeup. And so I would use the time on the island to finally worry about me in all that heat.
And finally, if you could only keep one of these discs, which would it be?
Oh, my goodness. I think it would be Grace Jones, La Vie en Rose. I think I'd be on the island in full beat with lots of colours on my cheekbones, dancing to La Vie en Rose over and over again. That's it.
Pat McGrath, thank you so much for sharing your desert island discs with us.
Thank you. This is fun. I've enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Pat. She brought a number of her team with her for the recording. It felt not unlike a whirlwind on the shores of our little island. I could really understand why she's known throughout the industry as Mother. Another luminary of the fashion industry is the designer Vivienne Westwood. Together with Malcolm McLaren, she was at the forefront of the punk movement in the 70s. In 1992, Vivienne was cast away by Sue Lawley.
The hallmarks of punk, Vivienne Westwood, which you and Malcolm McLaren invented together in the early 70s, was anarchy and destruction. How did you arrive at that invention? What was the thinking behind it?
Punk rock was essentially an exercise about rock and roll. And Malcolm once said that rock and roll is the jungle beat that threatens white civilization. And it is essentially the idea that youth, what wishes to attack authority. Of course, youth will always wish to attack authority. But I think that punk rock was a really fantastic and heroic attempt to understand whether there was such a thing as an establishment that, like a kind of door that you could almost sort of kick and have some sort of effect on.
So you began, if you like, to dress these ideas, to put clothes on these kinds of ideas, and you ended up... well, you describe it. I mean, if someone had never seen punk, what would you say were the hallmarks of it in fashion terms?
It was built up from all the motifs that we'd been sort of exploring in terms of what this rebellion, this youth rebellion would be. And the first thing was the Teddy Boys. And then we got bored with the Teddy Boys because they seemed to be more interested in having loads of records and collecting all the right ones and having all these Sun label records and everything. And we got more interested in rockers with their slogans. And we renamed our shop Too Fast to Live, Too Young to Die, which was a rocker slogan. And we started to get all these T-shirts with chains on and all these black things.
And leather, that was where the leather came from, said the rockers.
Yeah, it was, right, that's right. And then the next thing that we did, because we weren't satisfied enough with that, is that we got arrested for doing this T-shirt, which was supposed to be pornographic, of two naked cowboys. And somebody was wearing it in Piccadilly at the same time as the programme about Johnny Go Home, and it was all about rent boys in Piccadilly, and the police were in there, and they saw a man wearing this T-shirt, and they arrested him. And we got done for that.
Well, because the cowboys' penises were hanging out at the time, weren't they?
Yeah, I can remember the verdict of the judge in saying why it was pornographic. It was that they were too close together in the respect that you've just mentioned, that their penises were too close together, and that also they were over large, so he said, and also one of them was tying the other's necktie. Anyway, that was the clincher.
And then on from there came the whole fashion of bondage and straps.
Yeah, so we decided to just go all out for that then, and we called the shop Sex and started to sell more pornographic T-shirts and also to put all this rubberware in there. And then also the other influence on the punk was the fact that we had the shop walls had been at one time in our first shop been covered with all these little pictures from 50s pin-up magazines with girls in all this torn clothing. And so we started to rip clothes in that way as well. And so more or less we had all the things that we needed, and we made this cult of our own, this punk rock.
Vivian Westwood talking to Sue Lawley in 1992. You can hear many more editions of the Desert Island Discs back catalogue on BBC Sounds. Next week, my guest will be the illusionist and mentalist Derren Brown. Join us then.
This is Planet Puffin.
There's a fair chance you will get bitten at some point.
Planet Puffin is a new podcast coming to you from a tiny island off the east coast of Scotland.
Across the summer, we're going to be following the breeding season, no matter what it takes.
Now, there's an encouraging piece of poo at the entrance.
There's some nice white guano.
So, Becky, I'm going to let you take the first game of Puffin Roulette.
Summer 2019's hottest Puffin podcast.
Well, only Puffin podcast.
For BBC Sounds.